Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
So, welcome to the Talky Bit, as Tim says. For anybody who's listening to this on the podcast or watching online who doesn't know me, my name is James, and I'm just filling in for Tim Plett while he's away. Yeah, so today it is my pleasure to introduce to you a book called The Book of Joy. And this is a book by, I've read it recently, this is a book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And there's a third co-author, I'll tell you a bit about that as well. The theme of the book is obvious in the title, but I want to say at the outset that it could be argued that this book could equally be about the beauty of friendship. These two men have a remarkable, and you see it in the book, they have just a remarkable, warm, and loving, and lighthearted friendship, which I absolutely, I don't know, it kind of caught me by surprise. I really delighted in that while I was reading the book. It's of course, and I'll talk a bit about that later as well. It's a friendship between these two that is, I would say, it seems unlikely. They're from different parts of the world, from very different cultures, from very different like language groups, religious traditions, and yet it seems as though their friendship is built on a lot of common ground as well. I want to give a bit of a background on the creation of the book. It's a pretty unique book. Back in 2015. They kind of collaborated on this. And actually, what happened was the Dalai Lama invited Desmond Tutu to come to Dharamsala in India, where he lives, to celebrate his 80th birthday. Desmond Tutu was 84 at the time, so the Dalai Lama's turning 80. Desmond Tutu spent a whole week, or almost a week, out there with him. And there were, and so this book kind of touches on all of that. There was a few purposes for his for the trip. One was to celebrate that 80th birthday, and there was even a surprise birthday party that was kind of thrown in there that kind of appears in the book. I think they just wanted to spend some time together as friends, and I think it was the most time they'd ever spent together. They're both busy leaders and so forth, so they were just really looking forward to that. And they wanted to. They had this shared intention of collaborating to make, to have a series of conversations, sort of interviews or discussions on the topic of joy that would then culminate in the creation of this book. So that's basically the background of how this book came to be. And I want to start with a bit of a biography of just a little reminder of who Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama are. So we'll start with the Dalai Lama. He's the 14th Dalai Lama. He was recognized as the reincarnation of his predecessor, the 13th Dalai Lama, when he was 2 years of age. And he was enthroned as the Dalai Lama around the age of four, I believe. Fascinating story. If you ever get a chance to kind of check it out in terms of how they found him, it's mystical, there's divinations, there's lots which they deferred on and then went back to later on just to prove his legitimacy. There was a lot drawing process. And he had to, the Dalai Lama, as a two-year-old, was presented, part of the tests to kind of confirm his legitimacy was, there's all these objects that were brought before him in, I think, in pairs. And he had to select from these objects which ones were his, as in his from his previous incarnation as the previous Dalai Lama. And apparently he aced the test. So fascinating, I think. He was born Tenzin Gyatso in a rural farming family in Tibet. He's still alive today at the age of 89. And just so you know, the word Lama could be translated spiritual master, which I didn't know before I kind of researched this. So the Dalai Lama is the spiritual head of the largest school of Tibetan Buddhism. He's also considered sort of a symbol of Tibetan identity and culture. And he's a Christ-like figure within Tibetan Buddhism, in the sense that he's considered a bodhisattva. And what that means is this is a person who is able to reach nirvana, but delays doing so out of compassion in order to save suffering beings. So he's very, very, very special to the Tibetan people. If you would ask the Dalai Lama himself, or when you hear him describe himself, at several points in the book, he basically is like, I'm nothing special. I'm just a Buddhist monk, just one of 7 billion people on the earth. I mean, I think it's now 8.2 billion on the earth right now, but that's how he described himself back then. So as of this year, he has been exiled from his homeland, Tibet, for 66 years. A little background on that relationship between China and Tibet, because China took over Tibet. It's kind of like the relationship between, if you're not aware, it's kind of like the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, where Russia is like, oh, Ukraine, it's always been part of us. You're really one of us. We should really just take you over and make this official. And the Ukrainians are like, well, we don't feel the same way about it. It's kind of like that with China and Tibet. Probably an oversimplification, like I say, but it's something like that. Tibet itself is about 12.8% of China's current landmass, when you include Tibet as a province. It only has 3.5 million people within a population of, 1.4 billion people? So it's pretty insignificant population-wise, but significant landmass-wise. So the Dalai Lama took over political leadership of the Tibetan people at the age of 15. He was only supposed to... He was already sort of the spiritual head, but he was only supposed to assume political leadership at the age of 18. But around that time, China had invaded Tibet, and the people, and I don't know, maybe other leaders, asked him whether he would kind of come early into that role of political leadership, which he agreed to. And then for the next 9 years, so in 1951, China annexed Tibet. And from 1950 to 1959, the Dalai Lama spent a lot of effort, of course, into advocating for his people, trying to negotiate with the Chinese and find a political solution to this problem. And ultimately, in 1959, he fled Tibet basically under the threat of his life. There was uprisings happening. There was a lot more scrutiny or attention from China and military attention that was being focused on Tibet. And so he fled to India, where he's been a guest of the Indian government ever since. So, about his leadership politically, he actually stepped away from his role as a political leader in 2011, because in order to make way for a democratic process democratic government to lead the Tibetan people. So he's still the spiritual head, though, of Tibetan Buddhism. About his exile, the Dalai Lama is actually, and it comes through again in the book, he is very thankful, he says, for his experience living in exile, his experience of being a refugee. And he says that because if I had stayed in Lhasa in Tibet, he basically said, I would have been in a gilded cage. You know, I would have been in this, sure, beautiful 1,000-room palace or whatever. But it is a gilded cage, and I would have had very little contact with the rest of the world. There wasn't a lot of contact between the Dalai Lamas previously and the rest of the world. They were pretty closed off. But this forced him out of that gilded cage, and through his continued advocacy for the rights and for the cause of the Tibetan people and for Tibet itself, it brought him into contact with political leaders, with human rights activists, crusaders for justice, and so forth. And he also continued, besides the Tibetan cause, he himself has championed various human rights issues around the world and taken on global environmental problems as a cause as well. And for all these things, the Dalai Lama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989, I think it was. So he also says that he's had much greater contact with other world religions because of his exile. He wouldn't have had that otherwise. And I'm amazed by the Dalai Lama. He has just an amazing childlike quality, but also a very sophisticated, he's very well educated, and he has a curious mind. And for decades, I think for more than 40 years now, he has deliberately sought out and engaged dialogue with leading scientists around the world from a variety of disciplines, not only the social sciences, but he's engaged people to be his biology tutors and so forth. He just really wants to not be kind of like some kind of anachronism or something like that. He wants to really engage. He describes himself as, and probably his whole religious tradition, as non-theistic, which is a little different from atheistic. It's basically, he says there's, he delineates theistic religions, which most of the religions in the world are, from non-theistic religions, which include Buddhism and Jainism and another school of philosophy, I can't remember the name of it, that kind of is within the, kind of precedes both of those within the Hindu tradition. And he basically says, like, it basically implies that, one, there is no creator God, in a sense, because the universe, the physical world, has just always existed. So we don't have a creator God that we attribute the creation or the created order, or whatever, however you would say that without a creator. You don't have a creation deity involved here. This basically doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that there's not possibly spiritual beings. There can be spiritual beings and so forth. They have some limitations upon them and all this kind of thing. But the point about being non-theist is that whatever spiritual beings or gods might be out there, they're more or less tangential to the whole pursuit of, or the discipline of the practice of the discipline and the philosophy of Buddhism. So that's the gist on that. And I found that I had a sense that I thought Buddhists were maybe atheists or something like this. So that was interesting for me while I was preparing this to kind of learn a little bit more about all of that. Desmond Tutu, before I talk a little bit about his biography, I want to talk, kind of set in context his historical and kind of political milieu that he was raised in. So let's remember that in 1948, institutionalized racial segregation policies in South Africa, which were created, which were known as apartheid. And this allowed South Africa to be politically, socially, and economically dominated by the white minority. It's actually important, and I would say profoundly sobering, for us to be reminded of Canada's connection to the creation of that awful system. The South African government used used Canada's Indian Act as their framework for creating apartheid. Let's just let that sink in for a moment, you know? And I guess related to this and on a personal level, in 1987, so this is like 40 years after the beginning of apartheid, I was in grade 11. And I still remember my history teacher saying that year, Brian Mulroney had traveled to Africa. He was touring some countries, not South Africa, but some other neighboring countries there. And he described the apartheid system as odious and evil. And this was in the media and so forth. And my teacher noted that the response of the South African ambassador to Canada was to come to Manitoba and, with media in tow, tour Pegwa's First Nation up in the Interlake, which was a very impoverished First Nations community. And basically, he wanted to point out, he was trying to embarrass our government by saying, well, look at your kind of racism that you have that is still institutionalized and endemic here in Canada. So that kind of embarrassed the Canadian government, and well, it should have. So back to Desmond Tutu. He was born in 1931, so he was 17 years old when apartheid officially became institutionalized, or policy or institutionalized system in South Africa. He was born of a mixed Xhosa, or I think it's maybe Xhosa and Motswana heritage. And as a little aside, I think it's a big shame that we don't have smacks and clicks in the English language, because I really kind of like that. But anyway. So he's born to a very poor family in Klersdorp in South Africa. His father was abusive. He was an alcoholic. It's something that comes up in the book as well, as Desmond Tutu continues to, in the book, kind of wrestle with that, with those memories and so forth, and how it relates to the theme of joy when you have this kind of trauma in your childhood. As a child, he also contracted polio. As a teenager, he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. He was in a tuberculosis hospital or sanatorium for, I think, a year and a half. He almost died of tuberculosis. And then at the age of, or just after high school or whatever, first he went on professionally to be a teacher, and then shortly after that, pivoted and went into ministry, became an Anglican priest, trained in the UK. So during this time, let's fast forward now to about the 80s. Nelson Mandela is in prison. Most if not all of the other prominent political leaders or opponents of apartheid were all imprisoned. And so there was kind of a bit of a void of leadership. So Desmond Tutu stepped into that void and was able to do so, and was able to be protected from some of the consequences that the likes of Mandela had to experience because of, A, his clerical robes and his very prominent position that way. And then B, eventually he also won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1994. And so that also gave him a degree of immunity from like the, I guess the media attention and so forth. It would have been a really bad look to throw a Nobel Peace Prize winner into jail as well. So he really became for a long time sort of the most prominent face of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. He stressed nonviolent protest. He encouraged other foreign countries to apply economic pressure and embargoes on South Africa. He was the first bishop in South Africa, first black bishop, I should say. He was the first black archbishop in South Africa. And when he became archbishop in 1986, it was actually technically illegal for him to live in the archbishop's residence, because it was basically within an allocated whites-only neighborhood. But there he's the archbishop and living in that spot. So I think the apartheid system basically crumbled in 1994. There was free and open democratic elections where blacks could vote. Nelson Mandela, of course, became the first president of that iteration of South Africa. And Nelson Mandela appointed Desmond Tutu to be the chair of their Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a new idea, I think, at the time. I don't think there was one, at least by that name or of that kind of prominence before that. And, of course, their Truth and Reconciliation Commission became sort of a template for many other countries, including Canada, to use. After the fall of apartheid, he really continued to campaign on justice issues and especially gay rights. He had already been a very big proponent of gay rights before, but he really pivoted to that or shifted to that. And there's a little quote I wrote down here. He said at one point, "I would refuse to go to a homophobic heaven. I would much rather go to the other place. I would not worship a god who is homophobic." So he also campaigned for things like Israel's treatment of Palestinians, which he, I think, rightly also labeled as an apartheid system. And he advocated for the Tibetan cause, which is, I'm sure, part of how he developed this relationship with the Dalai Lama. He died in 2021 of cancer. I'm also going to mention one other author. So the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, the big authors of this book, there's another co-author, Douglas Abrams, his name is, who basically, he's the co-author, listed as a co-author of the book. He kind of planned and facilitated these discussions, did a lot of pre-planning for it, gave kind of some shape to the discussions that they had throughout that week on the topic of joy. He considers himself or calls himself a people's ambassador. Some of the questions that he brought to the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu were sort of crowdsourced from all over the world, including questions that he said this came from a child named so-and-so or whatever. So that was kind of a neat thing that he felt like he was just representing the whole world to kind of seek the wisdom of these two quite amazing individuals. He describes himself as a secular Jew, this Douglas Abrams. And so he said, he kind of joked in the book how it sounds like the setup to a joke, like a Christian, a Buddhist, and a Jew walk into a bar, et cetera, et cetera. So I kind of like that. And he himself also gave credit, though, the name isn't in on the kind of like the credits of the book, but he gave credit to another man, a Buddhist scholar named Thupten Jinpa, he's a Buddhist scholar. He had been a Buddhist monk. He left his monastic life. He's a religious scholar. He has a PhD in religion. He got married and lives in Canada somewhere, apparently. And anyway, he has been the Dalai Lama's English translator for 40 years as of 2025. Anyway, Abrams gives him credit for helping prepare questions and kind of prepare the shape and flavor of the meetings that were had that week, as well as helping him as a non-Buddhist interpret some of the answers that were coming. I can't recommend this book more. It's such a unique little book. It has a few different elements to it. There is a narrative aspect of it where basically it kind of like tracks their activities during the week. It's like, well, we had these discussions all morning and there's this dialogue that goes back and forth and then we broke for lunch. And then it kind of describes them having lunch and also further conversations that are happening around the lunch table and all that. So it is a bit, it's kind of narrative in flavor. It includes, of course, as I said, there's a surprise birthday party for the Dalai Lama within the book that's kind of described. A central part of the book, of course, is these dialogues between the two of them and facilitated by Douglas Abrams on the topic of joy and various varied parts of the human experience that relate to joy. The book also frequently weaves in, and sometimes this is, especially the Dalai Lama will reference these things, but he really wanted Douglas Abrams to kind of incorporate this as well. But he weaves in a lot of stuff about scientific current scientific and especially social science research into things like joy and happiness. So that's also kind of woven into the book because they really wanted to see that there was sort of a carryover. The Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu did not want this to be a Christian book or a Buddhist book. They really wanted it to be a universal book, something that was of value to all mankind. And so they also want to bring in that secular scientific voice to kind of inform the discussions as well. I actually listened to it as an audiobook, and I would highly recommend, I mean, I generally listen to a lot of audiobooks more than reading books for a variety of reasons, but this one's particularly good. The Dalai Lama's and Desmond Tutu's voices aren't in the audiobook, but they do have some like voice actors whose accents and cadence of speech is very similar to the Dalai Lama and to Desmond Tutu's. So I think that is a really good way to experience it. It's available through Libby using your Winnipeg Library card. I should also mention that there's a documentary with a different name. It's called Mission Joy, Finding Happiness in Troubled Times. You can also view that through Hoopla, which is available through your Winnipeg Library card. I would also recommend that one. It's not trying to be what movie ever really does justice to the book, right? I don't think they're trying to replicate the book in it. It's more of a companion to the book, and it's really lovely to like watch them interact. They're the kind of, I'll get to it in a moment, but their friendship is really quite rich. So that's kind of fun. There's a lot more stuff about the background, Dalai Lama's background, Desmond Tutu's background, their people's backgrounds and history and struggles. And it does have, of course, less of the meat and potatoes of this book in terms of those discussions, but there is a reasonable amount of it as well. And then the last thing I wanted to say here about the kind of the preamble, my very long preamble, is that they also put out The Little Book of Joy, which is for little people. Beautifully illustrated and very simple in terms of the text and so forth. But if anyone wants to look at that, I have it here. Just pass it around if you like. So about their friendship, it's a real bromance. These guys, they're constantly there. When you can see it in the movie, but they're also, it's described when you read or listen to the book. They're constantly like holding each other's hand, caressing the other person's hand, brushing their cheek. Like these guys are just all over each other. Just really, really love each other, and they're not afraid to show it. Something that I thought was really neat was that they really respected and wanted to engage with each other's religious traditions and experience. So one point in the book, the Dalai Lama invites Desmond Tutu and the kind of crew that was with them into his home, into I don't think he called it a chapel, but basically he has a prayer room in his home. Apparently this is his kind of like his refuge. Not a lot of people go into his home. It's his little sanctuary. But invited him in there, and when they arrived there, they found that he already had a few objects, Christian objects. There was a crucifix that was there. There was a statue of Mary possibly holding the baby Jesus too, I think. So he wanted to kind of incorporate that. The Dalai Lama introduced Desmond Tutu to his meditation practice, which Desmond Tutu was glad to take in. And Desmond Tutu, interestingly, in the Dalai Lama's little prayer room in his home, served him Eucharist or communion, which is really interesting because a lot of Christians wouldn't necessarily even serve communion to somebody who wasn't their specific brand of Christian. I mean, I certainly grew up in that type of tradition, right? Kind of on that note, it was interesting that the Dalai Lama, of course, his monastic vows prohibit him from taking in alcohol, but there is wine in communion. But the Dalai Lama decided he was going to kind of break his monastic vows, and he dipped his finger into the wine glass and put a drop on his tongue. But I thought that was a courageous thing to do as a leader of a spiritual tradition, and everyone's kind of holding you to this high standard. I thought that was kind of a neat interfaith experience and dialogue that they had. One little other thing about their friendship, and this is a bit of a digression. So within Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist psychology, they believe that there are a series of stages that people go through in their consciousness, shifts or stages in their consciousness that they go through as you're dying. And the Dalai Lama said, I do a meditation 5 times a day where I go through those, I visualize and go through that meditation, the dying meditation, so that I can be prepared for when that day comes. I get choked up easily. Here I'm probably going to cry. At one point during the week, as I think the last day, he was mentioning this, and then he references Desmond Tutu, and he says, and I mean, honestly, due to their age, their health, especially Desmond Tutu's health, he only died a few years later, I think they both had this very tangible sense that this could be the last time we're together. And he basically said he was gazing at Desmond Tutu, and he said, kind of like that, he was creating a picture in his mind of him. And then he said, this picture, a special picture, he says, I think at the time of my death, I will remember you. Which I thought, like, wow, what a powerful friendship these guys had for him to say that to this man from a completely different religious tradition and everything. They often refer to each other as their quote-unquote mischievous spiritual brother. There's a lot of, Desmond Tutu tells this story often, how the second time he met the Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lama stole his cap off his head and put it on his own head. Like, it wasn't like a religious cap or anything, it was just a cap, but kind of pinched it off his head and put it on his own head, that kind of thing. In the book, there's places where Desmond Tutu chastises the Dalai Lama and wags his finger and says, ah, you're a holy man, behave like a holy man, right? Because they're just being silly. They're joking around. Dalai Lama's talking about how, you know, they're talking about, in one part, about pleasure, you know, and that there's certain pleasures that you know, the role of pleasure and joy, and these traditions, there's some restrictions on certain pleasures and stuff. And Dalai Lama's like, yeah, like sex, right? And Desmond Tutu's like, what? Behave like a holy man. You're not supposed to talk about that or whatever. So it's kind of funny. Anyway, on to the meat and potatoes. So the book covers an amazing breadth of human experience that all they bring these things all back to joy. So this, I'm going to read a little list. This includes compassion, suffering, adversity, acceptance, pleasure, fear, anxiety, gratitude, loneliness, chronic stress, envy, generosity, humility, anger, forgiveness, connectedness, sadness, grief, despair, humor, illness, and death. So quite a ambitious thing to kind of cover all these things, and kind of neat to see how they brought it all back and found joy as a central theme. So I don't want to presume that I can encapsulate all the amazing teachings in this book, the wisdom that comes from their traditions and also from their experience. Because as I've reviewed in their biographies, as I kind of recounted here, they have both undergone an incredible amount of personal adversity and have really taken on behalf of their entire people group, an incredible amount of suffering and diversity and fought for those things. So I do want to give you a little snippet, though, into a few of the things that they talked about. So one of the topics, just to focus in on one of these many topics, I want to talk a little bit about some of their teachings and wisdom around suffering and adversity. They shared certainly from their own experience, but each of them told stories about close friends of theirs or associates whose response to suffering inspired them. So for Desmond Tutu, he talked, for example, about Nelson Mandela. He talked about how Mandela was this angry, young, violent young man when he went into prison. He goes to prison for 27 years, and he emerged a completely different person. And Archbishop Tutu talks about how that experience really refined him, refined his character. He came out not as a broken man, but as a gentle, loving, magnanimous person, a completely different person than when he went into prison. The Dalai Lama, amazingly, when he fled Tibet in 1959, another Buddhist monk who he was quite close to was captured by the Chinese. And that monk was sent to a Chinese torture camp for 18 years. And not only did they use Chinese torture methods on the prisoners in this camp, including this Buddhist monk, but they also took the best of or worst of or whatever you would call it of Soviet-style torture and Japanese-style torture to really refine their techniques on these people. So you can only imagine. I can't imagine the kind of suffering that man experienced over 18 years. And when he came out of that and he was talking to the Dalai Lama, he talked about how worried he was during those 18 years about the real dangers he faced in that camp. And the Dalai Lama's like, yeah, of course. I mean, your life was in danger all the time. He says, no. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the real danger, the possibility that I would lose my compassion for these Chinese guards and Chinese torturers who had been torturing me. That's what worried him. And that, like the Dalai Lama, I mean, I find that inspiring. The Dalai Lama found that so inspiring. So that's one story that he relayed. This co-author, Douglas Abrams, I think it was his father. He actually shared his own story too, where his father had gone through a terrible illness and suffered a great deal. And sort of, it sounds like when he kind of got to the end of it, I think it was his own brother, was talking to him and said, hey, I'm so sorry that you had this terrible, terrible experience. And his father replied, I really was amazed by this one as well. It struck me. Oh, no, not at all, he says. It's all part of my curriculum. So more teachings or wisdom from these two men on the topic of adversity and suffering. They emphasize that we must not deny suffering, but acknowledge that this is a shared human experience. It's basically about giving us perspective. It's a shift from ourselves towards others, from anguish and through to compassion, basically. Our pain is lessened by realizing that we do not suffer alone. And this is important. It's not contrasting our situation with others, seeing somebody else who's suffering, going like, wow, their situation is actually much worse than mine. So I should be thankful that I'm not suffering in this illness as much as that person who is suffering so much more. It's not a contrast kind of thing to be kind of thankful, try to lessen your suffering, which I kind of assumed that that's what the point was. But they said, no, it's not that. It's about uniting our situation and our suffering with the suffering of others. They talked about how the word compassion itself comes from, it really means suffering with. Compassion means, the first part is with, and then passion is suffering. So they said basically it's about connection, and it's the birth of empathy and compassion when you can suffer with others and kind of see your own suffering as part of that greater whole. I thought that was quite profound. They emphasize at several points throughout the book how beauty and joy do not come without some suffering, and even intense suffering, because our suffering helps us develop that compassion. And how we face the negative things in our lives determines the person that we become. Now, I know these are two men that are talking here. It's a very male-dominated world kind of viewpoint that they're putting out there. But they did talk about how childbirth, they saw childbirth as an amazing metaphor for how pain and suffering can give rise to something beautiful and a very joyful experience of welcoming your child into the world. They talked about how there's a tendency for pain, both physical and mental pain, to cause us to be very self-focused. And the challenge, they said, is to learn how to shift our perspectives to be others-focused, despite our pain. Or they basically described, the more we can heal our own pain, the more we can turn to the pain of others. But the way we heal our own pain is actually by turning the pain to the pain of others. It's a virtuous cycle, they said. So the more we turn toward others, the more joy we experience, and the more joy we experience, the more we can bring joy to others. So those are a few of the thoughts that they had on pain and suffering. One other little thing, kind of delving more deeply into one other topic, they talked about mental immunity, which they didn't use the word, but I kind of think of this as sort of like resilience. They talked about mental immunity and how it takes time to develop and that there's no quick path or quick fix to get there. And they described the process of developing that mental immunity. They basically said, first, you need to accept the reality of suffering, which in large part means letting go of control. And then once you've done that, to recognize that our responses are not reality. We can choose our responses to those. We can choose fear, we can choose frustration, or we can choose anger in response to our suffering, or we can choose fearlessness, we can choose love, kindness, and forgiveness. And I mean, as I'm saying this, it just feels so trite to throw these like wise pearls of wisdom out from these gentlemen, but it's really, I mean, this is a lifelong journey, and for those, I mean, we've all suffered in various ways in this room, or know people close to us who have suffered maybe more than we have. We know that this isn't an easy thing at all. But that's the steps that they kind of described as being necessary to build that mental immunity. Often our negative emotions are mental projections, they said, on situations or people. So sometimes others act in a way that feels negative towards us, and sometimes, or even I would say usually, our own attitude and behaviors are contributing factors that cannot be ignored. So when we recognize our role, this can reduce our negative emotions. We can also develop compassion for the way the other person feels that have led them to act this way. So again, that's all kind of under that umbrella of mental immunity. Kind of near the end of that kind of didactic or whatever discussion section, they basically come up with what they call 8 pillars of joy. I'm going to mention them quick, but then we're also going to use these 8 pillars to do a little bit of a meditation here at the end. So one is, there are 4 qualities of the mind. Those are perspective, humility, humor, and acceptance. So again, those are qualities of the mind, the first 4 pillars. And then there are 4 qualities of the heart: forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity. And compassion and generosity were the two, those last two were ones that I think the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu agreed that were the most pivotal of those 8 to creating lasting happiness and joy. So I would just want to kind of wrap this part up by reading a little, 2 little quotes from near the end of the book, little summaries, the impressions of the author Douglas Abrams on kind of the cream that rises to the surface at the end of a week like this. So here's the first quote. The two leaders had told us over the course of the week that there is no joy without sorrow, that in fact it is the pain, the suffering that allows us to experience and appreciate the joy. Indeed, the more we turn toward the suffering, our own and others, the more we can turn toward the joy. We accept them both, turning the music of life up, or we turn our backs on life itself, becoming deaf to its music. They also told us and demonstrated that true joy is a way of being, not a fleeting emotion. What they had cultivated in their long lives was that enduring trait of joyfulness. They had warned us that we cannot pursue joy as an end in itself, or we will miss the bus. Joy comes, rather, from daily thoughts, feelings, and actions. And they told us repeatedly the action that gets us on the bus. Bring joy to others. And then a shorter quote, and I'll end with this part. Adversity, illness, and death are real and inevitable. We choose whether to add these unavoidable facts of life we create in our own minds and hearts, the chosen suffering. The more we make a different choice to heal our own suffering, the more we can turn to others and help to address their suffering with the laughter-filled, tear-stained eyes of the heart. And the more we turn away from our self-regard to wipe the tears from the eyes of another, the more, incredibly, we are able to bear, to heal, and to transcend our own suffering. This was their true secret to joy.